A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's a new father, 11 months in, and the pediatrician visits got him thinking. He points out something that had honestly never occurred to him before. In pediatrics, the patient can't tell you what's wrong. No, it hurts here. No, this started Tuesday. You can run blood tests and scans, but a huge chunk of the diagnostic picture that every other specialty relies on is just. So his question is really two things. First, what kind of unique skills does it take to be a good pediatrician, beyond just liking kids? And second, what kind of physician is actually drawn to this work?
I love this question. I love it because it gets past the surface assumption immediately. And as someone who did this for years, I can tell you, the communication thing is the whole game. It's not just that babies can't talk. A 2-year-old can talk, but they can't localize pain. A 4-year-old can point to something, but they might be pointing to where they want the problem to be, or where they remember it hurting yesterday. An 8-year-old can give you a history, but they're filtering it through a brain that still thinks in magical causation. And a 14-year-old can give you a perfectly articulate history that is completely wrong because they don't want their parent in the room and they're mortified by the actual problem.
Every age is a different translation problem.
And the translation isn't just language. It's developmental stage. It's family dynamics. It's the fact that the parent in the room is also a narrator with their own anxiety and their own interpretive lens. You're triangulating constantly. You're looking at the child, you're listening to the parent, and you're running a separate diagnostic thread for each of them, plus a third thread for the interaction between them.
The triangulation point is interesting, because in adult medicine, you've got the patient's account and the physical exam and the labs. Here you've got a fourth data stream that's just the space between the parent and the child.
Sometimes that space is where the diagnosis lives. I remember a case early in my training. A mother brought in her 18-month-old because he'd stopped walking. He'd been walking for 3 months, and then over the course of a week, the resident before me had ordered a full neurological workup. MRI, lumbar puncture, the works. So I'm in the room, and I'm watching this mother interact with her son, and I notice that every time he tries to pull himself up on the coffee table, she gasps and scoops him up. I asked her, gently, whether she was worried about him falling. And she burst into tears and told me her nephew had fallen at this age and fractured his skull. She'd started intercepting every attempt her son made to stand. The kid wasn't neurologically impaired. He'd learned that walking made his mother panic. So he stopped. The kid read the room perfectly. And the diagnosis was maternal anxiety manifesting as a pediatric motor regression. You don't find that on an MRI.
That's one skill right there. Reading the room. But that feels like it's adjacent to a whole cluster of things. Observation, pattern recognition, being able to watch a child move and breathe and interact and see what's off. How much of pediatric diagnosis is just?
It's enormous. In adult internal medicine, you can do a lot with the history alone. Studies suggest something like 70 to 80% of diagnoses can be made from the history before you even touch the patient. In pediatrics, especially with preverbal children, the physical exam and observation carry a much heavier load. You're looking at respiratory patterns, not just rate, but the quality, retractions between the ribs. You're looking at skin color, muscle tone, the quality of the cry. Is it high-pitched and neurologic, or hoarse and infectious, or that particular exhausted whimper that tells you this baby has been working too hard to breathe for too long?
The cry is a diagnostic instrument.
A trained pediatrician can hear a cry and narrow the differential significantly. There's the cri du chat, cry in a specific genetic syndrome that sounds like a cat mewing. There's the high-pitched, piercing cry that can indicate increased intracranial pressure. There's the weak, grunting cry of a baby in respiratory distress. These are real clinical signs, not folk wisdom. But here's the thing, you also have to know when the cry means nothing, when it's just a tired baby who's had enough of being poked. because if you overreact to every cry, you order unnecessary tests, you admit kids who don't need to be admitted, and you terrify parents. The skill isn't just hearing the abnormal cry, it's confidently identifying the normal one.
The pediatrician is constantly managing a signal-to-noise problem where the signal is buried in crying and parental worry, and a patient who can't articulate anything.
The noise is often louder than the signal. That's the job. You're listening for a whisper in a wind tunnel.
Let me ask you something. When you were practicing, what was the hardest age to diagnose? Because the prompt mentions an 11-month-old, and that's right in that pre-verbal window. But you've got newborns who can't do anything but exist, and you've got teenagers who can speak but might actively mislead you. Where's the hardest ground?
Honestly, the toddler years. Roughly 12 months to 36 months, newborns are in some ways easier because their repertoire is limited. You know what normal looks like, and deviations are often dramatic and catchable. Teenagers are challenging for the reasons you said, but you can at least negotiate with them. Toddlers can't be reasoned with. They can't reliably localize pain, they're in a constant state of emotional volatility, and they're developing autonomy, which means they often resist the exam just on principle. You're trying to assess a toddler's abdomen while they're arching their back and screaming because you're a stranger. Is that scream pain, or is it, I don't like you? Distinguishing that is genuinely one of the hardest things in clinical medicine.
How do you do it?
Examining the parent first, let the child see that you touching the parent doesn't hurt. Sometimes you examine the child on the parent's lap rather than on the table. You listen to the heart and lungs before you do anything invasive. You save the ears and throat for last. And you watch the child in the waiting room or while you're talking to the parent. That's often when you get your best observation because they're not performing for you yet.
A good pediatrician is part doctor, part child psychologist, part stage manager.
Part translator and part detective. There's a phrase that gets used in pediatrics training. The child is not a small adult. It sounds obvious, but it's deeper than it seems. Children aren't just smaller versions of grown-ups. Their physiology is different. Their drug metabolism is different. Their disease presentations are different. A urinary tract infection in an elderly adult might present with confusion. In a toddler, it might present with just irritability and poor feeding. You have to know that fever without a source in a 2-month-old is an emergency requiring a full septic workup, but fever without a source in a 2-year-old who looks well is probably viral and can be watched. The same presenting complaint means completely different things at different ages.
The stakes are asymmetric because you're dealing with a developing organism. A misdiagnosis in a 60-year-old is bad. A misdiagnosis in a 6-month-old can alter the trajectory of an entire life.
That's the weight of it. And I think that's part of what draws certain people to the field and repels others. In medical school, you see students who love the intellectual puzzle of internal medicine, the long differential, the complex pharmacology. And some of them get to their pediatrics rotation and find it deeply uncomfortable, because you can't rely on the history the same way. You can't have a Socratic dialogue with your patient. You're operating with less information, and the stakes are arguably higher. Some people find that terrifying. The people who go into pediatrics tend to find it.
There's something about working with incomplete information that appeals to a certain kind of mind.
And I want to be careful here, because it's not that pediatricians are comfortable with uncertainty in a cavalier way. It's that they've developed a higher tolerance for ambiguity, paired with strong heuristics for knowing when ambiguity is acceptable and when it's dangerous. That's the real skill. Not eliminating uncertainty, but calibrating your response to it.
The prompt also asks what kind of physician is drawn to pediatrics, and you started to answer that. Comfort with ambiguity, observational intensity, a high tolerance for the signal-to-noise problem. But I wonder if there's also something about the longitudinal relationship. Pediatrics is one of the few specialties where you watch a human being develop from birth to young adulthood.
And I think that's the part that doesn't get talked about enough. When I was practicing, I had patients I'd seen since they were 3 days old. By the time they were 18, I'd watched them learn to walk, learn to talk, go through school, go through puberty, develop their own personalities. You're not just treating episodes of illness, you're shepherding development. And that means you're constantly asking, is this normal? Is this variation within the normal range, or is this a deviation that needs intervention? And the answer changes every 6 months.
That's a different frame than treating disease.
It's fundamentally a different frame, and it attracts a different kind of doctor. In medical school, there's a stereotype that pediatricians are just the nice ones, the ones who like kids and want to hand out lollipops. And look, liking kids helps. But the pediatricians I respected most were diagnostically intense. They were the ones who noticed the subtle things. The growth curve that had flattened before it dropped. The developmental milestone that was achieved but with an odd quality. The family dynamic that felt just slightly off. They were rigorous in a way that was almost invisible to an outside observer, because so much of the rigor was in the watching and the listening.
The invisible rigor. That's a good phrase. Because from the outside, a pediatrician visit can look almost casual. You're chatting with the parent, you're making faces at the baby, you're doing a quick exam. But what's actually happening is a dense, multi-layered assessment.
The layers aren't obvious. Let me give you an example. A 12-month well child visit. The parent is in the room, and I'm asking about feeding and sleep and milestones. While I'm doing that, I'm also watching the child's spontaneous movement. Is there any asymmetry? I'm watching the child's eye contact. Is there social referencing? I'm watching the parent-child interaction. Is there appropriate attachment? I'm looking at the growth chart and calculating velocities, not just absolute numbers. I'm doing a physical exam that includes checking the red reflexes in the eyes to rule out retinoblastoma, palpating the abdomen for masses, checking the hips for dysplasia, assessing the fontanelle. And I'm doing all of this in about 20 minutes while maintaining a conversation that makes the parent feel heard and the child feel safe. None of that is casual.
It's the medical equivalent of a restaurant kitchen during dinner service. Looks chaotic to the diner, but there's a brutally efficient system running underneath.
And the system is built on pattern recognition that's been drilled over thousands of patient encounters. You develop what's essentially a Bayesian framework in your head. You know the base rates for everything at every age, and every observation updates your priors. The two-week old with a fever? That's a different prior than the two-year-old with a fever. The six-month-old who's not sitting yet, maybe normal, maybe not, depends on tone, depends on other milestones, depends on the prenatal history.
One thing I want to pull on, you mentioned the parent-child interaction as a diagnostic data stream. How often is the parent actually part of the clinical picture?
More often than anyone wants to admit. And this is delicate territory, because most parents are doing their absolute best, and the last thing a pediatrician should do is make them feel scrutinized or blamed. But the reality is that parental mental health, parental knowledge, and parental behavior are often the most modifiable factors in a child's health. Postpartum depression can present as failure to thrive in the infant. Parental anxiety can present as excessive visits for minor complaints. Health illiteracy can present as medication errors or missed appointments. And sometimes, rarely, but sometimes, you're looking at a situation where the parent is the pathology. Munchausen by proxy. Those are the hardest rooms to be in, and pediatricians have to know how to read them.
That's a skill set that goes well beyond medical training. That's almost investigative.
It is investigative. And pediatricians are mandatory reporters. If you suspect abuse or neglect, you're legally required to report it. That means you're constantly running a background process in your head. Is this injury consistent with the history I've been given? Does the developmental stage match the mechanism described? Is there something about this interaction that's raising my hackles even if I can't articulate it? And you have to do it without alienating parents who are innocent, because if you get it wrong, you've damaged a therapeutic relationship that might be essential to that child's care.
The pediatrician is simultaneously the family's ally and, in some potential future, the state's witness.
That tension is real. And it's one of the things that makes pediatrics emotionally demanding in ways that other specialties often aren't. You're not just managing disease, you're managing families. You're navigating cultural differences about feeding and sleep and discipline. You're having conversations about vaccines with parents who've been exposed to misinformation. You're talking to a 14-year-old about sexual health while their parent is in the waiting room, figuring out how to respect the adolescent's confidentiality while keeping the parent appropriately informed. The emotional labor is significant.
Let's talk about the vaccine conversation specifically, because that's become a flashpoint. How does a pediatrician handle that well?
The research on this has evolved. The old approach was to present facts and assume that information deficit was the problem. If parents just understood the science, they'd vaccinate. But that doesn't work, because vaccine hesitancy isn't primarily about information. It's about trust, it's about perceived risk, it's about identity and community. The effective approach is something called a presumptive format. Instead of saying, "What do you want to do about vaccines today?" you say, "We're going to give the vaccines that are due today." You present vaccination as the default, not the option. And if the parent pushes back, you don't dismiss their concerns. You acknowledge them, you explore them, and you share why you, as the doctor, vaccinated your own children.
The "I vaccinated my own kids" move is powerful.
It's one of the most effective things you can say. It shifts the frame from "the medical establishment says" to "I, a person you know and trust, made this choice for the people I love most." And I think that's another thing about good pediatricians. They know when to be the authority and when to be the fellow parent. The balance between those two modes is delicate, and it changes depending on the family and the clinical situation.
You mentioned the emotional labor. The prompt's author is a new father. He's probably seeing the pediatrician from the parent's side of the room. And I wonder if there's something about the performance of calm that's part of the skill set. Because as a parent, you're anxious, you're sleep deprived, you're bringing in your most precious thing in the world, and the pediatrician has to project a kind of, not false reassurance, but not alarm either.
The calibrated reassurance. That's exactly it, and it's harder than it looks. You have to be honest. If something is concerning, you have to say so. But you also have to contain your own concern so that the parent can process the information without panicking. I used to tell residents, when you walk into a room with a sick child, the parent is watching your face before they hear your words. If you look scared, they're scared. If you look calm and focused, they can stay with you. So you learn to modulate your affect, not to hide the truth, but to deliver it in a way that the parent can actually hear and act on.
It's bedside manner, but with an extra layer of performance, because you're managing two audiences at once, the child and the parent, and they need different things from you in the same moment.
Sometimes they need contradictory things. The child needs you to be gentle and playful and non-threatening. The parent needs you to be competent and thorough and direct. You're doing both simultaneously. You're making the rubber glove into a balloon animal while you're explaining the risks of febrile seizures. It's a strange job.
Let's go back to something you said earlier about the diagnostic weight of observation. I'm curious about the specific physical exam skills that are unique to pediatrics. What's something a pediatrician does in an exam that an internist wouldn't?
The newborn exam is its own universe. You're checking primitive reflexes. The moral reflex, the rooting reflex, the grasp reflex, that disappear after a few months. You're assessing the hips for developmental dysplasia using the Ortolani and Barlow tests, which have to be done gently because you can actually make things worse if you're too aggressive. You're looking at the red reflex in the eyes to screen for congenital cataracts and retinoblastoma. A missed red reflex can mean a lost eye or a lost life. You're checking the palate for some mucus clefts that might not be visible but can affect feeding. You're counting cord vessels. Two arteries and one vein is normal. A single umbilical artery can be associated with renal and cardiac anomalies. None of this is part of a standard adult physical.
The cord vessel count is a good example of something that seems trivial, but is actually a screening tool for serious congenital issues.
It's one of those things that, if you don't know to look for it, you won't see it. There's a whole library of age-specific findings that just don't exist in adult medicine. The school-age child exam includes checking for scoliosis with the forward bend test. The adolescent exam includes assessing Tanner staging, which most adult doctors haven't thought about since medical school. And at every age, you're plotting growth on curves that are specific to that age and sex and sometimes even that condition. There are special growth charts for Down syndrome, for Turner syndrome, for prematurity.
The growth chart as a diagnostic instrument. Most parents just see it as, is my kid big enough? But you're reading it differently.
The absolute number matters less than the velocity and the pattern. A child at the 5th percentile for weight who's tracking along the 5th percentile consistently is usually fine. That's just their growth channel. A child who drops from the 50th percentile to the 5th over 6 months is a problem, even if they're still technically within the normal range. Weight dropping before height suggests inadequate nutrition. Height and weight dropping together suggests a systemic illness. Head circumference crossing percentiles upward can mean hydrocephalus. Downward can mean craniosynostosis. The growth chart is basically a longitudinal diagnostic test that's administered for free at every visit.
It's the cheapest medical test in existence, and it catches things that MRI machines miss.
And it's one of the reasons well child visits matter even when the child seems perfectly healthy. You're not just checking a box, you're collecting data points that, over time, reveal patterns that no single visit could show.
We've covered the diagnostic skills, the observational intensity, the family dynamics, the developmental surveillance. What about the actual personality traits? The prompt asks what kind of physician is drawn to this. You've mentioned comfort with ambiguity and tolerance for the emotional demands, but I suspect there's something else.
That's an interesting word.
Because in a lot of adult medicine, you're managing decline. You're slowing the progression of chronic disease. You're palliating. You're trying to buy time. In pediatrics, you're mostly managing growth. The trajectory is upward. Even when a child is seriously ill, the goal is usually restoration, getting them back on their developmental path. That seems like it would attract a different emotional temperament.
You've put your finger on something real. When you treat a child with pneumonia, they get better, often dramatically and quickly. Children have enormous physiological reserve. They can be terribly sick and then bounce back in a way that astonishes adult physicians. When you treat a child with asthma, you're not just controlling symptoms, you're keeping them on the soccer field, you're preventing school absence, you're preserving normal development. The wins in pediatrics are often complete wins. And that's deeply satisfying. But there's a flip side. When the losses come, they are devastating. A child with cancer, a child with a degenerative disease, a child who dies. Those losses hit differently than in adult medicine, because you're losing a whole unlived life. And the pediatricians who last in the field are the ones who can hold both, the joy of the wins and the weight of the losses, without being destroyed by either.
That's a specific kind of emotional resilience, not detachment. You can't be detached and be a good pediatrician, but something more like the ability to grieve and then show up the next day and be fully present for the next child.
And I don't think it's teachable in any formal sense. You learn it by doing it, and some people discover they can do it, and some discover they can't. The ones who can't usually leave, they go into pediatric radiology or pediatric pathology where the patient contact is limited. And that's not a failure, it's self-knowledge.
Let's talk about the subspecialties for a moment, because the prompt is about pediatrics broadly. But I think there's a perception that pediatrics is a single thing. It's not.
Not at all. General pediatrics is the broad front line. The well-child visits, the acute illnesses, the developmental surveillance, the coordination of care. But pediatric subspecialties are their own worlds. Pediatric cardiology, you're dealing with congenital heart disease that adult cardiologists never see. Pediatric oncology, completely different tumor types and treatment protocols. Pediatric neurology, you're managing developing brains, which is fundamentally different from adult neurology. And then there's neonatology, which is essentially critical care for patients who weigh less than a bag of flour.
The bag of flour reference is not hyperbolic.
It's not. A 23-week preemie can weigh 500 grams. That's just over a pound. And you're managing ventilation and nutrition and neurological development in a patient whose lungs aren't supposed to exist yet. Medication doses are calculated to the microgram. Fluid balances are tracked to the milliliter. And you're doing all of it while communicating with parents who are in the worst moment of their lives.
The subspecialties take the core pediatric challenge. The patient can't communicate. The physiology is different. The stakes are developmental and amplified in specific directions.
They attract different personalities within the pediatric universe. The neonatologists I knew tended to be procedurally oriented, comfortable with technology, good in a crisis. The developmental pediatricians were patient, observant, willing to sit with ambiguity for long periods, because developmental assessments unfold over months, not minutes. The pediatric oncologists had a particular kind of emotional courage that I still find hard to describe. They form relationships with families that last years, through treatment and relapse and sometimes death, and they keep showing up.
It's almost like pediatrics isn't one specialty, but a family of specialties united by a common orientation toward the developing human.
I think the common orientation is something like, the patient is a work in progress, and my job is to protect the progress while treating the illness. Every decision is filtered through the question, how will this affect development? A medication that's fine for an adult might be toxic to a developing brain. A surgical approach that works for an adult might disrupt growth plates in a child. The pediatric mindset is fundamentally developmental, and that's what unifies the field across all its subspecialties.
The prompt's author is seeing this from the parent's side now, and I think there's something about becoming a parent that makes you see pediatricians differently. Before you have kids, a pediatrician is just a doctor who treats children. After, they're the person you hand your child to and say, tell me if something is wrong, because I don't know how to tell.
That's exactly the dynamic. And a good pediatrician knows that the parent is handing over not just a child, but a universe of anxiety and hope and inexperience. Part of the job is teaching parents how to parent, not in a condescending way, but in a here's what to expect, here's what's normal, here's when to worry way. You're doing anticipatory guidance at every visit. At the 2-month visit, you're talking about sleep and feeding. At the 12-month visit, you're talking about discipline and language development. At the 2-year visit, you're talking about toilet training and tantrums. You're not just screening for disease. You're preparing parents for the next stage.
The pediatrician is also an educator, and the curriculum is childhood.
The students are parents who are often sleep-deprived, overwhelmed, and bombarded with conflicting advice from the internet and their in-laws. You have to be clear, evidence-based, and non-judgmental, all in about 3 minutes per topic, because you've got 15 other things to cover.
3 minutes per topic. That's the reality of the well-child visit. And yet somehow, the good ones make you feel like you've had a full conversation.
That's the art. It's time management plus emotional presence. You can't rush and make the parent feel rushed. You have to be efficient without seeming hurried. And you have to know which topics to prioritize. Because you can't cover everything in detail at every visit. You learn to read the parent and the child and decide, today, the big issue is sleep. Today, the big issue is feeding. Today, the parent needs to talk about screen time. And you adjust.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier. The phrase, the child is not a small adult. That's been a mantra in pediatrics for a long time. But I wonder if there's a corollary. The parent is not a small doctor.
That's really good. The parent is not a small doctor. They're not a trainee who just needs more medical knowledge. They're a different thing entirely. They're the expert on their specific child, but they lack the general framework that the pediatrician has. So the collaboration is between two different kinds of expertise. The parent knows that their child isn't acting right, even if the vital signs are normal. The pediatrician knows that this particular not acting right is consistent with a viral illness that will resolve in 48 hours. Both pieces of knowledge matter. And the best pediatric care happens when both are respected.
The dual expertise model. That's a much better frame than the paternalistic doctor knows best, or the consumerist parent is always right.
It's where the field has been moving. Shared decision-making, family-centered care. These aren't just buzzwords. They represent a real shift in how pediatricians think about their role. You're not the authority who dictates care. You're the guide who helps the family navigate.
Which requires a kind of intellectual humility that medical training doesn't always cultivate.
No, it doesn't. Medical training cultivates confidence, sometimes to the point of arrogance, and pediatrics pushes against that in a unique way because you're constantly being surprised. The child who presents with classic symptoms of one thing and turns out to have something completely different. The parent whose intuition was right when your clinical judgment was wrong. Pediatrics teaches humility, if you're willing to learn it.
To pull this together, the prompt asked what unique skills make a good pediatrician and what kind of physician is drawn to the field. We've talked about observational intensity, developmental thinking, comfort with ambiguity, the ability to triangulate between child and parent, the performance of calibrated reassurance, the investigative mindset, the emotional resilience to hold joy and grief simultaneously. And the people drawn to it tend to be diagnostically rigorous, but interpersonally warm, comfortable with incomplete information, oriented toward growth rather than decline, and willing to be educators as much as clinicians.
That's a good summary, and I'd add one thing that we touched on but didn't name explicitly, patients. Not just patients with children, though that's part of it, patients with parents. Patients with developmental timelines that don't cooperate with your diagnostic schedule. Patients with the fact that sometimes the right answer is, let's watch this and come back in 2 weeks. In a medical culture that often equates action with competence, pediatricians have to be comfortable with watchful waiting.
The watchful waiting point is underrated, because the temptation to intervene is strong. The parent wants something done. The doctor wants to be useful. The system rewards billable procedures. Resisting that and saying time is the diagnostic tool here takes a certain kind of confidence.
And it's one of the things that separates experienced pediatricians from novices. The novice orders the CT scan. The experienced pediatrician watches the child walk across the room, sees that they're playing and interactive despite the fever, and says, "This is viral. Here's what to watch for. Call me if anything changes." That's not laziness. It's clinical judgment earned over thousands of encounters.
I'm thinking about the prompt's author again. 11 months into parenthood, a few pediatrician visits under his belt, starting to realize that this specialty he took for granted is actually extraordinary, and I think that's a common experience. You don't appreciate what a pediatrician does until you're sitting in the exam room holding your own child.
That's true of a lot of medicine, honestly. You don't appreciate it until you need it. But pediatrics is unique because almost everyone passes through it, either as a patient or as a parent, and yet it remains kind of invisible. People think of it as the doctor who gives shots and checks growth. They don't see the diagnostic complexity, the emotional labor, the developmental surveillance, the family navigation. It's a specialty that hides its difficulty.
The specialty that hides its difficulty. That might be the best description of pediatrics I've heard.
I think pediatricians prefer it that way. The good ones, anyway. They're not interested in performing their brilliance. They're interested in making the visit feel normal and safe, even when they're running a complex diagnostic algorithm in their head. The best compliment a pediatrician can get isn't, "You're so smart," it's, "My child feels safe with you."
That's a good place to land. One last question, though. If someone listening is a medical student or a pre-med considering pediatrics, what would you tell them to look for in themselves? How do you know if this is your field?
I'd say, pay attention to how you feel on your pediatric rotation. Not whether you like kids, everyone likes kids. Pay attention to whether you find the ambiguity energizing or exhausting. Whether you enjoy the puzzle of the pre-verbal patient. Whether you can handle the emotional swings. The 2-year-old with leukemia in the morning and the healthy newborn in the afternoon. Whether you find yourself wanting to understand not just the disease, but the family system around it. And whether you can imagine doing this for 30 years. Because pediatrics is a long game, the relationships are long, the developmental arcs are long, the payoff is long. If you need quick results and clear endpoints, this might not be your field. But if you want to watch human beings become themselves and help them do it, there's nothing like it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, entomologists believed that the iridescent blue of butterfly wings from the Kuril Islands was caused by pigment granules. They were wrong. It's structural, microscopic ridges that refract light. The pigment theory was officially debunked in 1941 by a Russian lepidopterist who dissolved the pigment entirely and found the wings still shimmered.
The wings still shimmered? That's almost poetic.
I'm not sure what to do with that information, but I'm glad I have it.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. You can find us at mywordprompts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. And send us your own weird prompts. We read everyone.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.